Tonight is January 9th. We're here at Spirit Israel learning Parshat HaShavua. Sefer Shmot, the book of Exodus, we're beginning this week in the yearly cycle of reading in the synagogue. And the first Torah portion of the book of Shmot, the book of Exodus, is called Parshat Shmot. The real. Yes. And tonight we're going to deal with something that I've never dealt with before and I've never taught before. I just started thinking about this on Shabbat 3 days ago, and without further ado, I'll show you the verses that I started to thinking about. We'll read them together, and we'll see there's really questions and difficulties there that demand our attention. So we're looking at Sefer Shmot, the book of Exodus, chapter 2, verses 1 to 10. Chapter 2, at the beginning of Exodus, verses 1 to 10. A certain man of the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. The woman conceived and bore a son. And when she saw how beautiful he was, she hid him for 3 months. Of course, you have to know here the background, that there is a gzeirah, decree of Paro, who has enslaved the Jewish people, that all male children born to the Israelites should be thrown into the Nile. And that's why she tried to hide him. When she could hide him no longer, she got a wicker basket for him and caulked it with bitumen and pitch. By the way, the word basket here is teva, which is the same word used back in chapter 6 of the book of Genesis for the ark. And just look at the parallels. Water was about to destroy the human race, and a teva was used to save a select remnant. Here, all the male children are being thrown into the water, and a teva is being used to save a select remnant. And by the way, it says clearly back in Genesis chapter 6 that the teva, the ark, was coated with pitch. The same thing it says here. It looks like Moshe, the boy who will be called Moshe, is in the same role as Noah and his family, a remnant to save. There was to save the human race. Here it's to save the Jewish people. She put the child into it and placed it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stationed herself at a distance to learn what would befall him. The daughter of Paro came down to bathe in the Nile while her maidens walked along the Nile. She spied the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw that it was a child, a boy crying. She took pity on it and said, "This must be a Hebrew child." Then his sister said to Paro's daughter, "Shall I go and get you a Hebrew nurse to suckle the child for you?" And Paro's daughter answered, "Yes." So the girl went and called the child's mother, and that's, of course, the sister's mother also. And Paro's daughter said to her, "Take this child and nurse it for me, and I will pay your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed it. When the child grew up, she brought him to Paro's daughter, who made him her son, probably at the age of 2.5, 3, when she was finished nursing him. She named him Moshe, explaining, "I drew him out of the water." So this story is, of course, beautiful and it's fascinating, but it has a number of unanswered questions and difficulties here. And they've really been bothering with me for the past few days. So let's go back to the beginning. I don't mean to focus on why the mother could have sheltered and hid the child only for 3 months. It's a good question. I don't want to focus on that. But from that point on in the story, beginning with the wicker basket and putting it by the reeds and the sister and the daughter of Paro and the finding and taking pity on it, there are so many unanswered questions and difficulties. So let's just throw it open. Anything here or many things bothering you on a first reading? Things that don't, unanswered questions, things that don't make sense.
Why she saved him? Right.
Why she saved him.
She knew it was a Hebrew child, and that was the decree, so why did she save him?
Yeah, that's a big question. And if we're talking, as it says, that the daughter of Paro, she is going against her father's decree and saving a Hebrew child, why? What's going on here? Sociologically, psychologically, within the family, what are the dynamics here? How could this be? That's a big question. Other problems? Issues?
I have one further along, but no.
Okay. I always wanted to know how, if she hid the fact that she spawned the baby boy, how they knew to send for her as a wet nurse.
The daughter did.
Yeah, but out of all the people, how did she pick?
It was her own daughter.
That one.
Well, I think the daughter was watching.
Right.
To see what the lady
would
do, so she probably just went up to her and said,
Which
makes me wonder, did Pero's daughter have an inkling or kind of have a feeling that this could have been the child's mother?
That's a good question, really. That's a good question also. Yeah.
Well, I just think it was a huge coincidence that a Hebrew girl, shows up when Pero's daughter picks up the baby and says, "Oh, I know a wet nurse."
And you wonder
if maybe she knew it was the mother.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Fred?
Well, the whole concept of floating them down the river seems a little half-baked to me. In terms of, does somehow putting him in the river make him non-Jewish or something, that it's the best way to give him away or something like that? Couldn't you, first of all, you're risking obviously drowning and all those other things. Second of all, you're risking the concept of how are they even going to find him, and couldn't it just keep floating down the river?
But it was in the reeds. Like, so it was kind of stuck there.
Well, it got stuck. That's how the thing came about. But as a plan of action, the whole thing...
He was going to die, for sure.
Right.
So taking a risk in a cave probably seemed like a good idea.
Yeah, but there's other ways to go about this without the putting him in the water type of thing.
So what I hear Fred saying is, what was the plan of action?
Right.
To me, that's the biggest question here. Then exactly what did the mother of Moshe, by the way, her name is Yocheved, we find that later on. What was the hope, the plan, the goal of Yocheved? Now you could say that this was just a desperate move. She knew if she kept the child at home, it would be taken from her and violently thrust into the river. So she just put it in a basket to gain a few extra hours, a few extra days. But that's kind of implausible. She must have had a plan. But what was she thinking? What was going to happen?
She put him in the reeds. She didn't just float him in the middle of the Nile. She said she put him in the reeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine her hope was that someone would find it. Maybe a non-Jewish woman would find that baby and keep the baby.
Okay.
To go wash their clothes there or something.
And maybe she really strategized, and maybe she knew that Pharaoh's daughter
whatever. Right. The more you think about this, you say there has to have been a plan. And what was the plan?
But then again, how would she know that Pharaoh's daughter wouldn't kill the baby because that was the decree?
Ah.
So
it's exactly what I've been thinking. Both what the two of you said. That it's first, I began with Fred. There must be a plan. What was the plan? And then what Janice said, there must be a hope that someone would save the baby. And then, well, how does she know that someone is not going to just kill it like you're supposed to do when you find a Hebrew baby?
Do we know if Pharaoh's daughter maybe wanted children and couldn't have children?
Ah, so we have to start thinking. I couldn't have done this better. I paid you all to say that at the right time. So you have to start thinking, can we figure out something about Pharaoh's daughter, about her upbringing, about her beliefs, about her needs? Why? Perhaps it almost looks like the mother of the baby Yocheved perhaps knew that this is the place where Paro's daughter takes her bath at certain days of the week, and they specifically brought the child there because they knew something about Pharaoh's daughter that would lend them to believe that she wouldn't just merely kill the child. So these are things I've been thinking for the past 3 days. And then I start looking at the Midrashic material. Well, to tell you the truth, first I looked in the classic commentators of the Middle Ages, what's called the Rishonim. That's Rashi, and that's the Ramban, and that's Ibn Ezra, the Sforno, the classic commentators that you always go to when you're looking for answers to questions, or you're looking for questions. And I didn't find anything in the Middle East authorities that would deal with these issues. Then I went back to the Talmudic literature, the literature of 2,000 years ago, the Talmud and the Midrash. And I found some fascinating things that hint to some answers or some directions. Don't say anything, I think, directly and openly, but open up some interesting possibilities. So that's the sheet we have in front of us.
I have one other question that kind of bothered me.
Yes.
It was a little further on. That she made him her son. She brought him to Pharaoh and said, hey, this is my son. How does she pass that on?
Yeah, that would mean that's Pharaoh's grandson.
Right, and is she married? Was it normal just to have a baby or adopt a baby? I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a Midrash that talks about that also in a certain
sense. Something else is implied here, because upon first sight of the baby, she said, this is one of the Hebrew boys. So she must have been able to distinguish physical traits that it was a Hebrew boy. Why would not her father, the Pharaoh, have come to the same conclusion when she brought him?
Okay.
Did they know that it was a Hebrew baby because it was more than 8 days old? Was it circumcised?
Ah, so indeed, this is great.
Mm-hmm. We are asking questions.
The Midrash, there is a Midrash that says that she saw that he was circumcised. I find that unlikely. Without going too much into the whole thing, there's good reason to believe that most of the Jewish people were not circumcising their children. Although you could say that most didn't circumcise their children, but the Levites did. And this was a Levite baby, okay. But I think there's an easier solution to the problem of how she knew it was a Hebrew baby. Well, who else would put their baby in the reeds? You know, you put two and two together. You know there's a decree out there to kill the Hebrew males, and now you find a baby that's hidden in the reeds, and it looks so pretty obvious.
So does that imply that she didn't tell her father where she found it, or her father made an exception to the decree, his own decree?
Don't know. We don't know. Right?
In the movie, he had a little
cloth. Say it again, please. I didn't see the movie. But I didn't see it. Tell me.
But that seems really dumb, actually. I was like, that was really dumb in the movie because I thought it was like, oh, you wrap it in a really cheap cover.
Uh-huh. Okay. So let's look at different material from our sages. Again, this is about 2,000 years ago. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Megillah, page 13a. This also appears in Tractate Sotah. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi once introduced an exposition of the Book of Chronicles as follows. All thy words are one, and we know how to find their inner meaning. Well, what that means is that the Book of Chronicles has lots of chronicles in it. Lots of chronicles of begats and more begats and different husbands and wives and their children. And in most of the cases, their names are unrecognizable. We don't know these names from other places in the Bible. But the Rabbinic Midrash has a pretty standard way of dealing with all these unknown names in the Book of Chronicles. They say this name refers to that person we already know, and he had a second name. And not only that, but many times in the Book of Chronicles, they say that these five different people or three different people are the same person. They must have three different names. In other words, they put everything together. They make a unified whole of both many different names in the Book of Chronicles and with other books in the Bible. That's why he says, all thy words are one. It all comes together. It all is a unified, comprehensive whole. And we know how to find their any meaning. It is written, and this is a verse from the Book of Chronicles, Chronicles 1, chapter 4, And his wife, the Jewish, bore Yered, the father of Gedor, and Hever, the father of Sochon, Yekutiel, the father of Zanoach, and these are the sons of Bityah, daughter of Paro, whom Mered took as a wife. Now that verse, which we don't recognize anyone there, except for Bityah, the daughter of Paro. So here it says explicitly that the daughter of Paro, and assumedly it's talking about the daughter of Paro that we're learning about in this week's Parsha, she had a name. Her name was Bityah. By the way, Bityah means Bat-Yah, the daughter of God. Pretty strange name for the daughter of Paro. Unless you'd say the name refers to the fact that Paro thought himself to be God. But then we wouldn't use the word Yah for God, which is really the Jewish word for God.
Did maybe she have a Jewish mother?
Ah, so let's look deeper. Let's look deeper. So anyway, this verse about the daughter of Paro, the rabbis understand it to be talking about Moshe. When it says, Bor Yered, the father of Gedor, and Hever, the father of Sochon, Yekutiel, the father of Zanoach, the rabbis say those are three names for the same man. That this girl, this young woman, Bityah, she bore Moshe. And Moshe has three names. I know this is kind of outlandish exegesis, over the top, she's saying. But for our purposes, that doesn't matter. But let's see what the meaning is. Why was she, Paro, called a Jewess? And she's called Bityah, the daughter of God with a Jewish name of God. Why is she called that? And of course, at the beginning it says, and his wife, the Jewess, bore these people, and these are the sons of Bityah, daughter of Paro. It's saying that Bityah, the daughter of Paro, was a Jewess. Why would it say that? Because she repudiated idolatry. As it is written, quote, and the daughter of Paro went down to bathe in the river, unquote. So the Midrash is very creatively interpreting the book of Chronicles in a kind of over-the-top fashion, but more to our point, it's interpreting our verse from the chapter we just read, which said, and the daughter of Paro went down to bathe in the river. It's interpreting that as an act of
cleansing herself of the idols.
Cleansing herself of the idols. And even more, perhaps, as an act of at least symbolic conversion, like immersion in the water, immersion in the mikveh. On some level, the rabbis are seeing this daughter as converting to Judaism. Now, there was no Judaism in those days, of course. The Torah wasn't given yet. We weren't called Jews. There were no laws. There's no conversion. But in a kind of prototypical fashion, she is a convert, she is a lover of God, she's a supporter of the Jewish people, she's a seeker after the truth, and not only is she all those things, but according to the rabbinic reading, her act of going to the river that day was part and parcel of her discovery or taken upon herself of this new type of identity. Now, of course, such an identity is by necessity rebellion against her father. So the rabbis are seeing her as a rebellious woman, as a religious rebel, as an iconoclast, someone who's searching for a new religious identity against the religion of the state and against her father, who's the head of the religion of the state. And there's something in the act of going to the river that day that symbolizes or represents her rebellion against the idolatry of Mitzrayim.
But was the whole idea of the ritual bath already an established moire that she would have known about?
No, but it doesn't matter.
Okay.
In other words, I'm not trying to tell anyone this is the pshat of the verse. This is the simple meaning of the verse. It's not. It's not, right? But the rabbis are asking and answering a question. And the question is, how could it be? What's going on that this Egyptian girl saved this boy? And their answer is not like Lori suggested, oh, that was a good suggestion, that she's childless and she's looking for a child, but that she is a religious seeker. And there was something in our heart that was developing some type of identification with these slaves, right, this strange monotheistic religion. And that very day, she was planning, or she was undergoing, some type of religious metamorphosis, and this child that she found fit into what was going on in her soul. And it wasn't just a matter of pitying the child, it was a matter of really adopting a new identity for herself, according to this rabbinic reading. And again, read it as an answer to a question. Why did she take upon herself to risk her life and save this child? Then it goes on, and Rabbi Yochanan, commenting on this, said that she went down to cleanse herself from the idols of her father's house, as we just said. Bore, or it says, coming at the word that says that this Jewish bore these three men, and we're saying they're all, the rabbis interpret them all as the same person as Moshe, but she only brought him up. Why she, does it say that she actually bore him? This tells us that if anyone brings up an orphan boy or girl in his house, the scripture counts it as if he had begotten him. But as far as what it's saying for her, that she really saw Moshe as her child, which is again about her effort to identify, not as an Egyptian, but as an Israelite. That she's really undergoing some type of religious rebirth, you can say, and giving birth, in quotes, to this child is part of this religious rebirth, and it's also about, like I said, it's also about rebellion, religious rebellion against her father. So let's just keep that in mind. And I brought some more sources. Yeah.
Can I just throw in a more, what I consider to be another possible explanation?
Absolutely.
Of all this? Okay. Being a woman of privilege, like a lot of people like that, she saw herself above the laws that applied to everyone mm-hmm. else. That would be number one. Number two, she didn't have a child. So that's a whole big, she wanted a child. Number three...
But that's your assumption, of course, but it could be.
Yeah, but, you know, she... Number three, she... finding a baby, he's not really a Jew, a Hebrew, an Israelite yet. He may be by genetics, which is not well ingrained in them, but he hasn't been raised yet to be anything. So she saw it as a blank slate in which she could now have this good-looking, cute child, and, you know, just, you know, it wasn't like he was already an Israelite and she was converting him like a five-year-old boy or anything like that. So she saw it as a just a simple opportunity that was, you know, filled her need and, you know.
Okay, it could be. But I would respond that the decree of Paro was that the newborn Hebrew male children should be thrown into the river. Not just children who were socialized into the covenant of Israelites.
But what he's saying is he didn't want the Israelites the opportunity to raise their children and have children and, you know, be a nation and have that. That's what the decree was doing.
Okay, I hear. Right. That's that's plausible. It's less exciting than the way the Midrash is doing it. That's possible. Right?
But that might explain why the Pharaoh did not object to his daughter having the child.
Right, that certainly does. Whereas in the direction we're going with this Midrash, we'd have to assume that there's a severe tension between Paro and his daughter.
Why do we have to assume that?
Because if she went against his will and brought this boy who was supposed to be killed, brought him into the palace, and if she's repudiating the idolatry, the state religion that Paro is the head of. So, Rona, you were about to say something?
Does it matter that maybe Pharaoh had many daughters and this daughter would be unnoticed?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be they did have many daughters. There's a midrash that says he had 59, I think.
Well, there you go.
One last thing. It takes 2 points to make a line. So do we have any other information 20 years later as she was his mother, that she was this religious convert later on?
We don't have.
She lived her life as Pharaoh's daughter in the court and all that type of thing.
We don't have anything. In the Torah, we don't. We have Midrashim. We have rabbinic interpretation. We don't have in the Torah too much to go on. We do have this verse in Chronicles that says the daughter of Paro is called Bitya, which is, again, the daughter of God.
But does he interact with her when he's 20? When he's
nothing, 50, nothing, nothing.
How could she be the daughter of God when there's 50-something of them?
So the idea is that she made herself into daughter of God by adopting the ways of the Israelite people. Right? I didn't say that point. Yeah. So look at this other midrash, which brings all the material that we just saw. Now I'm looking at Midrash Rabbah on the book of Leviticus. And it's bringing, again, the same verse from the book of Chronicles. And these are the sons of Bitya, the daughter of Paro, whom Merit took. We quoted that above.
And does that mean that was Merit took? Does that mean that was her husband?
Her husband's name was Merit.
Okay.
By the way, I have to tell you, when I first began reading this Midrash, I said to myself, Merit, that's a strange name, and I think I can think of a Midrash about it. And then the Midrash said what I was thinking. Because you know what the word Merit means in Hebrew? It means revolt. This rebel of a girl, her husband's name is revolution. So look what happens now. Rabbi Yeshua of Siknin said the name of Rabbi Levi. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Bitya, daughter of Paro, Moses was not your son, yet you called him your son. You too, though you are not my daughter, yet I will call, the word you is missing, yet I will call you my daughter. Even as it is stated, these are the sons of Bitya. And in parentheses, it means Batya, the daughter of God. So, she is being rewarded with this new name, Batya, which indicates her essence, that she's made herself into a close ally, as it were, of God. And then it quotes the last part of the verse that says, whom Merid took, this man named Merid, married the daughter of Paro. And the Midrash says, who's this guy Merid? We never heard of him. Merid, that's Kalev. If you remember Kalev, he was one of the 12 spies in the desert, to the time of Moshe. And of those 12 spies, two were the good guys and 10 was the bad guys. The good guys were Kalev and Joshua. So the claim is that the daughter of Paro eventually married one of the leaders of the tribes of Israel, whose name was Kalev, but he got the name of Merid. Rabbi Abba bar Kahana and Rabbi Yehuda ben Shimon differed. One of them said, Kalev was called Merid because he rebelled, Merid means he rebelled against the council of the spies. And like I just said earlier, he was one of the 12 spies, and he rebelled against the council, the 10 bad spies. And she, Paro's daughter, too, rebelled against the council of her father. Therefore, him who rebelled, come and take in marriage her who rebelled. So again, we're not meant to take this literally, so I think, but the imagery is very, very powerful. That we have here a religious rebel who marries a religious rebel. Now, she's the greater rebel. Her husband rebelled against the council of the evil spies, but she rebelled against the whole state religion, against her father, and she risked her life, I would say, to save this child. And the truth is that you can almost compare her now to Abraham, to Avraham Avinu. If you think of the Midrashim of Avraham rebelling against his father, the idolater, and smashing all the idols, and saying, no, I believe in one God, in a certain sense, this woman is risking her life, just like Avraham did, to proclaim the truth of the one God, and to keep that legacy alive by saving this Jewish child, who ends up being the savior of the Jewish people. So I find this pretty fascinating. Now, I want to see a few more. Perhaps time is going much quicker than I thought, so we don't have to read the next one. Or do we? Yeah, let's just read the end of the next Midrash from the Babylon and Talmud Tratate Sota. I'm in the last two lines of the first page. when the maidens saw that she wished to rescue Moshe, they said to her mistress, "It is the custom of the world that when a human king makes a decree, though everybody else does not obey, even if others don't obey, at least his children and the members of his household obey it. But thou dost transgress thy father's decree." And then the angel Gabriel came and beat them to the ground. Okay. Happy ending. But this midrash emphasizes the degree of conflict and tension between Bitya, the daughter of Paro, and the society around her. Not just her father, but all the other Egyptians. They want to be like good Egyptians and do what the king says. And she flies in the face of all that and saves this little boy. And then this midrash abroad says the same thing. She took pity in the teachers of her maidens told her to leave it alone. They write the same thing. I just wanted to show you how many different midrashim go in the same direction here. So, let me tell you what I'm thinking. And this ties in some of the things that we said at the beginning. So we asked ourselves, what was the plan? What was Yocheved, the mother of Moshe, thinking? Why did she put her son in the basket in the reeds by the river? So if we could put two and two together and come up with 4 and 8 and 16, so perhaps the fact that this young girl, Bitya, was in some type of religious turmoil, that she was searching for her identity, she was rethinking her place in her father's house, she was looking for an alternative to the idolatry of Egypt, perhaps that wasn't a secret. And perhaps it was known or suspected by some of the Jews. And perhaps also they knew that she went down to the river, this particular river, on certain days. And perhaps they knew that when she went to the river, she saw it not just as bathing, but there was some type of religious significance to it, or something like that. What I'm trying to say is, perhaps there was a plan here, a real plan, that the mother of Moshe and the daughter of Moshe said, "Look, all is lost, what are we going to do? They're going to come tomorrow and take the child and throw him in the river. What could we do? Well, we know there's an Egyptian woman who we've heard has some sympathies with us, and we know she goes to the river so and such a time and such a place. Let's try and make sure that she sees the child in the basket." So they put Moshe in the basket at that particular time, at that particular place, exactly where it would be seen by someone who was washing in the river, who was bathing in the river. And what they hoped would happen, expect would happen, really did happen. She found the child. Now what's going to happen at the moment she finds the child? It's not certain. Of course, she does have some, let's say, Judaizing sympathies. And we know perhaps she's done such things in the past. She's shown sympathy. And we've heard that she's searching for a new identity. But, and then what happens is exactly what the two women had in mind, the mother and the daughter. She opens up the basket, she sees the child, and she has pity. But at that particular moment, she has pity. But where is that pity going to lead her? Because at least according to the Midrash, her maidens tell her immediately, "We'll take the child and throw it into the river." That's what you're supposed to do. And at that moment, the sister shows up. And it's no coincidence. This was what they were planning. And the sister is Miriam. We know from later verses, she has the audacity, just think of the audacity, to go right up to the daughter of Paro and make a suggestion. Now let's go back to the verses. What does she say? So we're in verse 6, chapter 2, verse 6. When she opened it, she saw that it was a child, a boy crying. She took pity and then said, "This must be a Hebrew child." So at that moment, like the whole world is hanging in the balance. And you can see there's pity on her face, and she's undecided. What is she going to do? And her maids are telling her, "Throw it into the river." And at that very moment, that moment of decision, shows up, Miriam shows up as she had planned and makes an audacious suggestion. "Shall I go and get a Hebrew nurse to suckle the child for you?" What a crazy thing. There are lots and lots of Egyptian wet nurses. Why a Hebrew? But of course, Miriam is trying to hint to what she thinks is going on in the mind of the daughter of Paro, that this is a Hebrew child, and perhaps I should save him, and perhaps I should raise him as a Hebrew, perhaps I should let him connect to his identity, and perhaps through him I can connect to the Hebrew identity. And at the very moment, Bitya hears these words from the daughter of Paro, and all she has to do is say yes. And it could be that had Miriam not showed up at that moment, the daughter of Paro would have been undecided, would have perhaps thrown him into the river. I think it's beautiful. And of course I understand that what I've said is based on Midrashim that have no foundation in the simple meaning of the verses, but I can't think of a better explanation of what the plan was. Why these two women put the boy in the reeds there, and why Miriam was there at that very moment. There must have been a plan. You're about to...
No, I'm just scratching.
Okay.
No, sorry.
But, you know, also as the, you know, Pharaoh's daughter, you know, she might have... They may have looked at it, too, that if they gave it to just... If another Egyptian found it, they had more incentive maybe to turn the baby in, because then they can look like they're a good Egyptian and maybe elevate their status, whereas with, you know, with Pharaoh's daughter, she might have a little bit more flexibility to kind of work the system.
Yeah. I understand, yeah. So, I'm enthralled by the possibilities. I feel like I've understood possibly something that I haven't really even thought about for 30 years. So, if we go on, let's...
Well,
yeah.
Well, since it was all such a long shot, could part of the plan be that right from the beginning, God had plans for this boy and was somehow protecting him and guiding, you know, that this would happen, so to speak. And, you know, you see right from the beginning in his life sort of the hand
absolutely.
Of God guiding him to his destiny.
That the
destiny
could be absolutely.
Was very predetermined.
Could be, but I would say that doesn't necessarily contradict the things we've said.
I'm not saying
right, the things work themselves out on a human level, but it certainly could be there's a plan here. It certainly is possible. Okay. Let's just look at the Midrash HaGadol, another Midrash collection that I wrote at the bottom of the back side of the first page. When Batya says to the mother of the child, to Yocheved, take this child and nurse it for me. She said to her, I am fearful of the decree of your father, said the mother to Batpar, the bottom of...
No, I see that. Yeah. I just don't see it.
Oh, no, it's not in the text at all.
Okay.
It's our Midrash. The rabbis are adding over and beyond.
And
she said to her, it is from me that you are nursing him. In other words, we're looking at the verse that says, take this child and nurse it from me. Why those words from me? It would be enough to say, take this child and nurse it from me. And in order to explain those words from me, the Midrash creates here a dialogue in which the mother of the child, Yocheved, says, I can't take this child. They're going to come and take it from me. I'm going to get arrested for nursing this child. And Batya says, no. You can listen to me, you don't have to listen to my father. The reason I think this Midrash is important is because it's emphasizing that the daughter of Paro is clearly and unequivocally rebelling against her father. I'm not afraid of the decree of my father, she's basically saying. Yeah.
Well, one last thing, not to... But wouldn't it have been more logical once you have the kid to give it to an Egyptian nurse, because then you would think the father is continuing, the guards are continuing
right.
to scour all the Hebrews
right,
who are
right,
nursing.
Right.
So she put him back into danger by doing
right.
this as opposed to
right. That's a good point.
Rescuing him.
I was thinking about that, and you have to say that something like the daughter of Paro appointed 10 of her maidens right, to create a guard there around the house of Moshe's mother. In other words, there has to be here some
complex.
Type of guarantee that Egyptians won't come and take the child, which assumes that there's some type of conflict here again, some type of power struggle between the daughter and her father.
And if what we've said before is true, the overriding goal for Itiah was to make this connection, and maybe she wanted to, him to really have the early bond with Judaism.
That's a good point. That's a good point. She wants him to have that bond, but she also wants to get the child back and to raise it as some type of tangible symbol of her own religious search and development. Okay, so that is a fascinating story of three very strong, courageous, and resourceful women who basically save the savior of the Jewish people and create the whole possibility of the Exodus. That's powerful to me. What I want to do now, at this point, is look at another story right in the same area that turns out to have a very similar theme. So we're going back to chapter 1 of the book of Exodus. I just thought that, Carol Ann, this is probably the first time in a long time you've heard something from me that you didn't hear before.
I haven't heard this, that's true. I like it, though.
So we're going to chapter 1. Verses 15 to 22. Chapter 1 of Exodus 15 to 22. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. Now that phrase, Hebrew midwives, we're going to spend a little bit of time on, another few minutes. I'll just put it on the board. Hebrew midwives. Hamiyaladot ha-ivriot. Miyaladot, you can see the root, yud lamid dalet, yelid. Miyaladot are women who make yeladim, not in the sense of conceiving them, but of bringing them into the world. Ivriot, language of Ivri, Hebrew, the Hebrew midwives. So this is a story about the Hebrew midwives. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra, and the other Pu'ah, saying, when you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool. If it is a boy, kill him. If it is a girl, let her live. The midwives, fearing God, did not do as the king of Egypt had told them. They let the boys live, which of course was a tremendous act of rebellion, and also self-sacrifice. It's dangerous. They can be put to death. They can be executed. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing, letting the boys live? The midwives said to Paro, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous. Before the midwife can come to them, they have given birth. By the way, I have a student whose wife gave birth 7 days ago in the house before they even got into the car to go to the hospital. And the brit is at my home tomorrow morning. And God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and increased greatly. And because the midwives feared God, he established households for them. And by the way, it's not clear what that means. Households, there are different interpretations. Then Paro charged all his people, saying, every boy that is born you shall throw into the Nile, but let every girl live. So, I want to spend 5 minutes on that phrase, Hamiyaladot ha-ivriot, the Hebrew midwives. And I want to talk about that phrase in a kind of strange context. A long time ago, when I was doing my master's and doctorate in Jewish philosophy, I was the teaching assistant for a very important professor who was teaching the class to freshman college students in Jewish philosophy, the introductory course. And I remember the way he began the year. The first few words he spoke in the first class was the following. What is the meaning of the phrase Jewish philosophy? Is Jewish philosophy philosophy about things Jewish, or is it philosophy that is written by Jews?
Second.
Well, it's not clear. Because take, for example, someone like Spinoza. Spinoza was a Jew, but the content of his philosophy was not Jewish. But if you say that Jewish philosophy is philosophy written by Jews, then the philosophy of Spinoza is Jewish philosophy. But if you say Jewish philosophy is philosophy that is about Jewish things, then Spinoza's philosophy is not Jewish philosophy. So that was the question, what is Jewish philosophy? In other words, what are we going to study here? He was a very boring teacher, by the way, a wonderful professor, but a boring class. But anyway, a similar type of question comes up with that phrase, Hamiyaladota Ivriot, the Hebrew midwives. In Hebrew, but not just in Hebrew, also in English, the phrase can have two meanings. Of course, it could mean Hamiladota Ivriot, the Hebrew midwives, the midwives who are Hebrews. But it could also mean something else, of course. What else could it mean?
The midwives
who serve the Hebrews, but who might not be Hebrews. And it's completely unclear. Uh-huh. Completely unclear. So look at the machloket, at the disagreement of our sages over 2,000 years ago on this question. So we're going to go to the sources that I have on the third side, the second piece of paper. And this is from Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Sotah, page 11b. And the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, etc. Rav and Shmuel, these are two sages in Babylonia. One said, a woman and her daughter. And the other said, mother-in-law and daughter-in-law. The one who said a woman and a daughter identified them as Yocheved and Miriam. And the one who said mother-in-law and daughter-in-law identified them as Yocheved and Elisheva, Aaron's wife. In other words, both of these two sages read the phrase Hamiyaladot Ivriot, the Hebrew midwives, as midwives who were Hebrew. And there's an argument, who were they exactly? But now look at the next source. The next source is Josephus. Now, many of you probably have heard of Josephus, some of you haven't. Josephus was a Jew, but not a scholar, not a rabbi, not a sage. He was a historian. He was a Jewish historian. Actually, the truth is he began his career as a soldier. He was a general, a Jewish general, who led the Jewish forces in the Galilee, in the north of Israel, in the war against Rome in the year 70. But his forces were conquered, and he actually turned tail and joined the Romans. And he became a historian for the Roman armies. And once Rome won the war and conquered Jerusalem, he went back to Rome and wrote a number of books. One of them is called The Antiquities of the Jews, and it's stories written in Greek for the larger Hellenistic Empire, stories about the Jewish people. And he tells some of the stories, most of the stories, in the Tanakh, in the Bible. And he's not telling them as a sage, but he's telling them probably the way he learned them in Sunday school. And look what he says. He says, I'm reading, Antiquities 2, chapter 9, section 2, alarmed thereat, the king, on this sage's advice, ordered that every male child born to the Israelites should be destroyed by being cast into the river, and that the labors of Hebrew women with children should be observed and watch kept for the delivery by the Egyptian midwives, for this office was, by his orders, to be performed by women who, as compatriots of the king, were not likely to transgress his will. So you see, he's assuming that the Miyaladot Ivriot were appointed by Paro from among the Egyptian women.
Yes.
What was Pharaoh hoping to accomplish by ordering all the male children to die, why didn't he just murder all the children? Why didn't he let the daughters live?
Well, without men, obviously, there's going to be no possibility of rebellion immediately, because women don't fight in the army, like not in those days, and he was afraid of the Jewish nation revolting, as in earlier verses. So immediately, he's just trying to make sure there's no army to rise up against them. Of course, within a generation or two, there'll be no more Israelites. Clearly.
This chapter 19 that you read before, really, to me, would make it logical that these women, midwives, were not Jewish. Because they say the Hebrews aren't like the Egyptian women, they're like animals. Well, that's not... that's an insider talking... and they're popping them out before we can even get there. So that's the way insiders talk about somebody else.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a good point. That could be. Good point.
Also, the Hebrew women, if they're midwives, would probably not want to kill the baby, so it'd be more likely that she would hit the non-Jewish.
Right, right.
Non-Hebrew.
Absolutely.
And it's even say, Yoldechen et ha-Ivriot. It seemed like...
They're not Ivriot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. These are all possible hints this direction. Now, what I want to point out is that if it's true, if you want to go in the direction that the Miyeladot Ivriot are not Israelites, they're Egyptian, but nevertheless they feared God and disobeyed the command of Paro and saved the male children at the risk of their lives, well then it turns out that we have not just one but two stories here, one right after the other, of women, and not just any old women, but Egyptian women, who are taking upon themselves some type of act of civil disobedience to rise up against Paro and save the Jewish children. First, it's the Miyeladot Ivriot, and then it's the daughter of Paro herself. So certainly we're noticing here that there are two powerful stories about women who endeavor to revolt, to disobey and save the Jewish people. And secondly, it might even be that these are two stories that are not just about Jewish women, but specifically about non-Jewish women. I again find that very powerful. And now, I want to move to a third story. We just read the end of chapter 1 about the midwives, and we read the beginning of chapter 2 at the beginning of our class. In the beginning of chapter 2, we emphasize the birth of this boy Moshe and what happened in the first few weeks and months of his life. What we didn't emphasize is the first verse of chapter 1, which is about the marriage of the parents of Moshe. Chapter 2, verse 1. So I want to go back and look at chapter 2, verse 1. And all it says is, a certain man of the house of Levi went and married a Levite woman. That's all. And from there, Moshe was born. Now, we're going to read a midrash that seems to be, again, coming out of nowhere, to use Laurie's expression.
Made up.
Say it again?
Made up.
Yeah. Well, I like her body language, right? But we'll see that the Midrash reads that one verse in light of the two stories that surround it. The midwife story that comes before it, and the story of the daughter of Paro and the mother of Moshe that comes after it. Two stories about strong, rebellious women of deep faith, apparently. So the famous Midrash is as follows, and here it is at the last source I brought on these sheets. It says, and there went a man of the house of Levi. That's the verse we just read, chapter 2, verse 1. Where did he go? Why did it say he went and married? Just say that he got married. You never see in the Torah, he went and he got married. Okay, got married, good. What do you mean he went and he got married? So the rabbis say, where did he go? And what's going on? And what's the story behind this getting up and going? Rabbi Yehuda ben Zevina said that he went in the counsel of his daughter. Went means that he listened and he walked, he acted according to someone's counsel, the counsel of his daughter. Now, who's this daughter? Now, this daughter is going to be the same daughter that ends up helping to save Moshe. But the verse says that he just got married, had a daughter when he got married. Does that mean it's his second marriage? Yes. Does it mean it's a second wife? No. According to the Midrash, he's remarrying his first wife. Ah, what do you mean? He divorced her? Well, we're going to tell a story about this. You ready? The story goes like this. Atana taught. Atana is a rabbi of the Mishnaic period from before the year 200. Amram, that's the name of Moses' father. Amram was the greatest man of his generation. When he saw that the wicked Paro had decreed, quote, every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, end quote. He said, in vain do we labor. And here the word labor is a euphemism. In vain are we married and procreating. He arose and divorced his wife. All the Israelites thereupon arose and divorced their wives. In other words, how can we continue to get married and procreate when there's a Holocaust going on? Paro is taking all the male children and throwing them into the river. We cannot, in good conscience, have any more children. It's just causing death and destruction. So, the end with marriage. And he got up and divorced his wife, and all of the Israelites followed suit, according to the Midrash. His daughter said to him, Father, thy decree is more severe than Paro's, because Paro decreed only against the males, whereas thou hast decreed against the males and females. If there's no marriage, then not only males won't be born, even females won't be born. Paro decreed concerning this world, whereas thou hast decreed concerning this world and the next world to come. Because if there's no children born, those children that aren't being born are being denied this world and the world to come. Whereas if you have children and they're killed, at least they'll have a life in the world to come, said she to her father. And she goes on, in the case of the wicked Paro, there's a doubt whether his decree will be fulfilled or not. Whereas in thy case, though thou art righteous, it is certain that thy decree will be fulfilled. There's a mistranslation. It should be, because thou art righteous, it is certain that thy decree will be fulfilled. As it is said, thou shalt also decree a thing, it be established unto thee, etc. He arose and took his wife back. And they all arose and took their wives back. So according to the story, why does the verse emphasize that this man went and got married? Because the going to get married was an important event. He had a conversation with his daughter, in which she convinced him to get remarried to his former wife, and he got up and he had a second marriage, another ceremony with her. Now, according to this midrash, and again, like Laurie says, it's...
it's out there.
But, so what's the point of the midrash? According to the midrash, Moshe would not have been born had it not been for the wisdom and the tenacity and the courage and the audaciousness of this daughter of Amram, whose name was Miriam. That she convinced her father, who was supposed to be the Gadol Hador, leader of the generation, that his logic was faulty. And he listened to her and got remarried, and Moses was born. So look at the three stories we've read tonight, according to the Midrash. The story of the midwives, and the story now of the remarriage of Amram to his wife Yocheved, and then the story of the birth and the salvation of the baby Moshe. In all three stories, one right after the other, they're stories, at least according to what the Midrash tells it, they're stories of female ingenuity and audacity and courage. In two of the stories, it's clear from the Torah that that's what's happening. In this third story about Miriam arguing with her father, it only comes from the Midrash. But you have here three stories that really emphasize that the foundation of the salvation of the Jewish people came from women. Not only do you have that, but in two of the three stories, it's about, at least according to some interpretations, it's about non-Jewish women who worked together with Jewish women to provide the foundation for the salvation of the Jewish people. That's my thesis for tonight. So it was a little bit short. That's okay. Does anyone want to add, question, comment, object?
Well, I just have a comment, and it doesn't require an answer, but why doesn't it just say that?
Really,
I love it now. Yeah. But I love the explanation.
Well, let's think about what you said. And in the case of the midwives, it does say. It says there are the miladot ivriyot. We don't know if they're Jewish or not, but it certainly talks about their audacity and their forthrightness and their self-sacrifice. And in this third story, right, about the mother and the daughter and the daughter of Parod, also says explicitly that these women had courage, these women had tenacity, these women had some type of plan. It doesn't say what it was, but they had a plan. They were doing something, whereas the men, not only were they not doing anything, according to the Midrash, the men were doing something self-destructive. Right. So you know what? Since there's 5 minutes left, I want to add something. The truth is, there's a fourth story right here about the power of a female to save the Jewish people. And since we have time, I'll just show you the story. First we'll read it, and then we'll explain it. So the story is to be found not in chapter 2 or 3, but in chapter 4. At the end of chapter 4, it says in verse 24 the following. Chapter 4, verse 24. We'll read the verses, then we'll have to go back and explain them. These are three of the strangest verses in the whole Torah. Chapter 4, verse 24 and 25, 26. At a night encampment on the way, the Lord encountered him, the references to Moshe, and sought to kill him. God sought to kill Moshe. So Tzipporah, who's the wife of Moshe, took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and touched his legs with it, saying, "You are truly a bridegroom of blood to me." Whose legs did he touch, and what does it mean, what she said? And when he let him alone, she had a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. Strange story. Why would God want to kill Moshe? And it looks like the story says that Moses' son is not circumcised, and Zipporah, the wife, circumcises the child and flings the foreskin at someone's legs, let's say at Moses' legs, and says to Moses, "You're truly a bridegroom of blood to me." And at that point, God gives in. God stops attacking Moshe. She, Zipporah, saves Moshe from God's murderous advances. What is going on here? So clearly, again, it's a story about a woman saving the day, saving Moshe. But what actually is happening here? So let's go back and just understand the background. The background is as follows. Moses spent the first 2 or 3 years of his life in Paro's palace. With his mother and his father. But at the age of 2 or 3, when he was weaned, he was taken to Paro's palace and he grew up there. He clearly, therefore, grew up, although perhaps he was told that he was Jewish, perhaps he had a certain Jewish identity. He clearly did not get a very good Jewish education from the daughter of Paro in the palace of Paro. He grew up as an Egyptian prince with all the amenities and with the instruction and with the privileges, with the clothing, with the language, with the identity of an Egyptian, even if he knew that he was from Hebrew stock. And we know that he was unclear as far as his identity, because one of the first things that happens when he grows up, when he comes of age, and we can read the verses about this now, is in chapter 2, verse 11, sometime after that, when Moses had grown up, he went out to his kinsfolk and witnessed their labors. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his kinsmen. He turned this way and that, and seeing no one about him, struck down the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. Okay, so he's developing as a young man, and he has some type of identity crisis. He's never lived with the Jews since the age of 3. He wants to go in and see them, and he sees that they're slaves and they're being beaten, and he has the audacity and has the courage to stand up for justice and kill the Egyptian taskmaster. So certainly he has a strong, developing Jewish identity, in addition to the fact that he's been brought up as an Egyptian, so you can imagine a certain conflict inside there. But he shows his true colors and he stands up for his fellow Jews. Then the next day, when he went out the next day, he found two Hebrews fighting, so he said to the offender, "Why do you strike your fellow?" He retorted, "Who made you chief and ruler over us? Do you mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Moses was frightened and thought, "Then the matter is known." So how did the word get out that he killed the Egyptian? Behold, it had said that he looked this way and that, and there was no one there. The only person who saw it was the Jew that he saved. And that Jew must have stabbed him in the back, told on him. So just think of Moshe. He grew up as an Egyptian. Finds as a young man his Hebrew identity, expresses it, and the next thing he knows, he's stabbed in the back by the very people that he's trying to become part of, trying to save. And then what happens? When Paro learned of the matter, he sought to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Paro. He arrived in the land of Midian and sat down beside a well. So imagine Moshe, at the age of 14 or 15 or 18, raised as an Egyptian. Egyptian language, Egyptian dress, Egyptian culture, Egyptian education, with a memory of being born as a Jew, as trying to identify with those Jews, but being stabbed in the back, and now he's thrown out of Paro's land, he goes to Midian, he is a man without an identity. And then, the priest of Midian had seven daughters, he meets one at the well. She says to his father, I saw an Egyptian. He's dressed in this Egyptian, certainly. He speaks Egyptian. And he marries this daughter, and he lives for something like 60 years in Midian. He's no longer a Jew. What does he know about the Jewish people? He hasn't seen them for so many years. The Egyptians have repudiated him. He lives most of his life as a Midianite. Not only that, but a Midianite who's married to the daughter of the priest of Midian, who's apparently a priest of idolatry. And then it says in chapter 3 that Moses at the age of 80, how many years have passed since he's been in Egypt, since he's heard of an Israelite, of a Jew? At the age of 80, he's in the desert with his flocks and he sees this bush, this strange sight. He goes up to it, it starts talking to him, and the voice of God out of the bush says, go to Egypt and save my people, talk to Paro, and take the Israelites out of slavery. And Moses, of course, says, are you crazy? Moses says, no. And then God says, yes. And Moses says, no. It happens five times. Yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And we can understand why he says no. What are you talking about? I have a good life as a Midianite. I don't remember my Egyptian. I never learned Hebrew. You want me to save those Israelites? What do they look like? I've never...
They stabbed me in the back.
So if Moses was 80 when he went back to Egypt and talked to Pharaoh, Pharaoh must have been 100?
It was probably a different Pharaoh. It could have been a different Pharaoh. And the verse actually say that the men who had put a price tag on his life were no longer alive. But a long time had passed.
Stepbrother.
Yeah. Couldn't you just imagine having a dream which God talks to you and says, take the first plane for Nicaragua and lead a revolution. And you say, I don't know Spanish. It's just totally not me. What's going on here? It's like the worst nightmare in the world. Like we think of the burning bush as this wonderful revelation to Moshe. But from a psychological point of view, it must have been devastating. He's put that all in his past. It's behind him. What are you talking about? How can I do that? I didn't identify with those people.
Why was he picked? He wasn't particularly,
Look, that's another question. I want to finish my story. But clearly, one of the reasons he was picked was because he was an outsider. So at the end of the burning bush story, God says go, and then God leaves, and Moses never answers. So that at the end of the burning bush episode, which by the way could have gone on for many days, when God had said go and Moses said no, and God said go and Moses said no, yes, no, yes, no, God says go, but Moses never said yes. And you don't know. And I think that Moses doesn't know how he's going to react. And at the end of that story, the end of the burning bush, we find the following. I'm looking for the place. So I'm in chapter 4, verses 13 and 14 and 15 and 16. God says no. God says go. And the last verse is, verse 17, and take with you this rod with which you shall perform the signs. And like I said, Moses doesn't answer. He is probably conflicted. He's probably struggling in his mind. He probably thinks the whole thing is just a bad dream, or I wish it were a bad dream. And in verse 18 it says, Moses went back to his father-in-law Yitro and said to him, let me go back to my kinsmen in Egypt and see how they are faring. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. And it's so clear here that Moshe does not say to his father-in-law, I had a dream and I had a vision and God told me to save the Jewish people. I'm going to Egypt to lead them out of slavery. He doesn't say that. He just says, I'm going to see how my kinsmen are faring. And he probably says what he says because he really doesn't know what he's going to do when he gets there. Perhaps it was all a bad dream. Does he have the audacity and the courage to stand up to Pharaoh, to take upon himself this mission that is so far from where he is and what he's been doing for the past 60 years of his life? So the Lord said to Moses in Midian, go back in Egypt, for the men who sought to kill you are dead. So Moses took his wife and sons, mounted them on an ass, and went back to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the rod of God with him, and it looks like it's almost an afterthought. He took the rod of God with him, but is he going to use that rod or not? And it's hard to say, and perhaps he doesn't know himself. And then we get to our verses, that God tries to slay Moshe. And I gave all this background to get back to it now. What my suggestion is, and perhaps some of you have heard me talk about this in the past, or read something I wrote, perhaps we should read it as a psychodrama. That Moses really does experience God is trying to kill him. Because that voice from the bush was so frightening and so discombobulating and giving a mission that's so difficult and so strange and so far from where Moses is that he is dying of inner tension and conflict. And he's on the way back to Egypt, not knowing what he's going to do when he gets there. And it says, at the night encampment on the way, the Lord encountered him and sought to kill him. So just imagine Moses with these nightmares. Should I do it? Should I not do it? Who am I? Am I a Midianite? Can I go back to that Jewish identity that was never really mine to begin with? And he wakes from the middle of the night in a cold sweat and he's pacing back and forth. What am I going to do? Can I go through with this? Perhaps I should just go back to Midian and forget about it and hope that that voice never comes back to me. And he's going back and forth and he's pacing up and down. And then he starts just screaming. He's having a nervous breakdown. And his wife wakes up in the middle of the night. And what does she do? So Tzipporah, and remember she's a Midianite. So Tzipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin. So that means Moses was traveling with an uncircumcised child. Well, that's fine. He might have been uncircumcised himself. We don't know. It could be that most of the Israelites were uncircumcised. But she somehow knows that there's a covenant of Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov of circumcision, and she circumcises her son at that very moment in the hotel and touched his legs with it. She flings the foreskin at her husband, saying, you are truly a bridegroom of blood to me. What blood are we talking about? Blood of the covenant, blood of circumcision. And what I'd like to read this as is she is telling her husband in a very, very real and symbolic fashion that you are a bridegroom of the blood of the covenant to me. In other words, in my eyes, Moses, you're a Jew. You're of the circumcised. You're connected to that fate. And you have to, at this very moment, realize that's who you are. You can't deny your true identity. Accept the truth of the voice you heard at the burning bush and go and save the Jewish people. And at that moment, it says, and when he let him alone, with a big H at the beginning of the word he, at that moment, Moses experienced that God releases him because he has a moment of catharsis, a moment of clarity. Yes, that's who I am. I'm a Jew and I no longer have this struggle for my identity. I know who I am. My wife has shown the light to me that all I can do is follow the voice of God. And he's saved. Not only is he saved from his struggle and his crisis, his nervous breakdown, but he is saved in the sense he gains his Jewish identity at that very minute. And then he becomes Moshe Rabbeinu, the father of the Jewish people, and he goes to Egypt and he saves the Jewish people for all time. And whether you read it exactly like I presented or not, it's clear that this is a fourth story in which a woman is the one who saves the day, who saves Moshe. Right? First you have the midwives who refuse to kill the male children, and one of them they saved was presumably Moshe. And the second story is about the remarriage of the parents of Moshe, which creates Moshe Rabbeinu as a child. And the third story is when, again, women do what has to be done. I forgot to say, in the second story, of course, it's the sister that convinces them to get married. And in the third story, it's the mother of Moshe and the sister and the daughter of Paro that save him. And in the fourth story, it's a woman, his wife, who gives him his Jewish identity back. And I think that's a pretty powerful thing, all in one parsha. Okay.
How did God not kill him if he was going to kill him?
Well, if you read it, as I read it, it's a psychodrama. Moses experienced that this divine voice is going to kill him, but the minute he decided to identify with the voice and accept it, it was no longer difficult. It was no longer a killer voice. It was no longer a nightmare. It was a good dream.
That is so interesting. I never would see any of that in there. That was really interesting.